This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Our thanks to Rocky and Les Chateaux d'Adieu for that lead-in. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on April 14, 2022. While the politicians in the Texas legislature continue to try and distract us with archaic laws meant to prevent us from learning the true histories of this state, the historians, researchers, and curious among us continue to uncover, reclaim, and publish the previously ignored or overlooked histories of the many peoples and communities that are integral to understanding just how humanity got to where it is today. It has been just within the past decade or so that the city of Austin has begun to reckon with its own past in this way. As non-white populations within Austin continue to diminish due to gentrification and the rising costs of living within the city, city leaders continue to struggle and reckon with the racist policies begun and continued since white colonists decided to establish the first capital of what was then the New Republic of Texas on the banks of the Colorado River in the early part of the 19th century. As the authors of the recently published book, Forget the Alamo, have challenged us to do, we must be open to re-examining our pre-existing knowledge of history and the many dominant ingrained narratives that were documented and disseminated from the perspectives of just one group of people. In the case of the Alamo's history, they point out, those accounts came from the white male colonizers who were among, or who knew of one of, the vastly outnumbered defenders of the Alamo during the doomed 13-day siege that was part of the 1836 battle for state independence. Furthermore, the authors state, failing to challenge these narratives continues to obscure the importance of Hispanic, Black, and Native American peoples' contributions to Texas history, a legacy that will continue to impact us all until we reckon with it. As Martin Luther King so eloquently pointed out, quote, we are not makers of history, we are made by history, end quote. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at coop.org. I'm Michelle Manning Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside regular host Bob Daly and our regular guest commentator Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Our guests this evening are Rowena Dash, Executive Director of the Neil Cochran House Museum here in Austin. She is responsible for all aspects of the museum's daily operations, the historic property's preservation, and the creation and management of the museum's active schedule of rotating exhibitions. Also joining us is Tara Dudley, who is Assistant Professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research examines the contributions of African-American builders and architects to the American built environment, focusing on the antebellum and Reconstruction eras in Austin and Texas, and the architectural archives of New Orleans, Gens de Couleur Libres, the Free People of Color. Collaboratively, Drs. Dash and Dudley researched and published a project titled Reckoning with the Past, Slavery, Segregation, and Gentrification in Austin in 2021. Welcome to the program, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So since we'll be delving into some history this hour, let's start with each of you briefly giving an overview of your own backgrounds. Rowena, would you like to start?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I've been the executive director of the Neil Cochran House Museum going on 9 years now. I'm originally from Houston, so I'm a native Texan. Went to college on the East Coast, and that's actually how Tara and I first got to know one another. We both graduated from Princeton University. And came to Austin for graduate school. Never really thought I'd stay. My husband's from Baltimore, and we always thought that when he went to business school, we would leave. But fell in love with Austin, didn't want to leave. And when I finished up at UT, I ended up moving over to the Neil Cochran House Museum. There's not a lot of 19th century American art in Austin, and that's my field. So the NCHM was really a great place for me to land because the period of significance for our site runs from really the beginnings of Austin as a city in 1839 all the way up into the 1960s when we first became a museum. So from my standpoint, I've moved a little bit more into the history realm than art history, although we do a lot of art shows at the museum as well, which keeps me engaged. But that's how I ended up where I am today.
Great. Thank you. Tara, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I am an assistant professor, as you have said, in the School of Architecture, but I've had a longstanding relationship with the University of Texas. I'm a native of Lafayette, Louisiana, and then via Princeton and a brief stint back home, actually came to Austin for graduate school. And like Rowena, I never imagined that I would stay here in Austin or even pursue a PhD, which is ultimately what I did. And over the course of that time, also began working full-time in Austin at a local historic preservation consulting firm, HHM and Associates. And so through cultural resource management in the professional world, and then also academia, my exploration of historic preservation and the history of the built environment was broadened in that way. And in my research in graduate school and beyond, and in various projects that I've worked on in my career as a historic preservation consultant, encountering historic house museums like the Neil Cochran House Museum, but also being able to engage with those places with students, and student research and work are among the various things that I've been doing over the past few years. So that's the short version of how I ended up in Austin and doing this kind of work.
Interesting. Yeah. I've been surrounded by architecture my whole life, basically, because both my parents are architects themselves. And I've lived here in Austin since the mid part of 2018, basically. And even though my two oldest daughters both attended the University of Texas at Austin and also lived on West Campus, I have yet to visit the Neil Cochran House Museum, which occupies a pretty prominent location within the West Campus area of Austin. So with my ignorance in mind, could the two of you tell us about the building, its history, and how it came to be the Neil Cochran House Museum?
Sure. I laugh because we joke that we could fund our endowment with people like you, particularly as the city grows exponentially. There are more and more people who are moving to town who are unaware of us, but we're working hard to change that trajectory, and I look forward to giving you a tour someday. We do. We have a pretty prominent spot in West Campus. We're next door to a building that many people know who've been in Austin a long time, the Texas Federation of Women's Clubs, which actually is property that the Cochran family sold in 1931 during the Great Depression. And then that big kind of colonial revival building was constructed next door to us. We're the last piece of green space left in the West Campus area. There's nothing green between UT and Shoal Creek other than us. So, you know, we see ourselves as integral to the West Campus neighborhood and consider the people who live around us our immediate community. How we came to be built, our original size is not that of West Campus, but it was 17 and a half acres. So we covered a decent amount of ground that is today full of towers. And the Hill family commissioned Abner Cook, who was really the only residential builder of any note in the antebellum period, to build them a suburban estate in 1856. And it was a suburban estate in an area of town. It's called the Outlots. There were lots that were town lots, and then there were outlots. And our property didn't actually achieve an address until the 1870s because it was seen as so removed from town. The Hills were 30 years old, both of them, Washington and Mary Hill, had a one-year-old child when they took on this project. And it turned out to be too big of an endeavor for them financially. We know that over the course of construction, they sold 5 enslaved people. And then at the end of construction, they essentially sold on completion and they never moved in. The house also bears witness to their financial situation in the sense that it's built of limestone rubble, which is essentially chunks of limestone mortared together into walls. It became very popular actually in the 20th century, sort of as a veneer on homes, but we have 18-inch thick solid stone walls. And that differentiates us from the governor's mansion, which is also an Abner Cook project. Same floor plan, 6 columns across the front, looks very similar, but the governor's mansion was made of more expensive brick. So it gives you a sense of kind of the differences in the Hill's financial means. Fast forward 100 years to 1958, the Cochran family, which lived in the home for 6 decades, was looking to transition the home to a new steward. They were concerned about what might happen to it in someone else's private hands over time. And so they worked with the National Society of the Colonial Dames of America in Texas, who were at that time looking for quarters. And one of the Cochran daughters was a member. And the Colonial Dames actually purchased the site and opened it for the first time to the public in 1960. It was volunteer run until 2005, when the first professional staff was hired, the first director. And today we're a full-time staff of 3 with 2 part-time people. So one of our issues that we've been open to the public in some form since 1960, and yet we have only been active the way we are today for, you know, less than 20 years. And so sometimes we can feel a little bit like a startup that didn't get to actually have an opening because we weren't new. We've never been new, but the amount of activity we have today and the programming we're doing is very different from what it was when the museum was volunteer run.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I wanted to talk about the parallel history that was going on next to the house, which is that of the Wheatville community, the Freedom Colony, that was really right there next to it. And when I put those two parallel histories together in my mind, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. And I wonder how the house and the families that lived there and the organizations that took over the building through those early years, how those two coexisted in the same space, so to speak.
Well, they were really our first neighbors, the residents of Wheatville, back when there was no one else nearby. And Tara's done a lot of research into this subject, and I think she's the right one to respond to that question.
Yeah, Wheatville was established more or less in 1869. And of course, the community got its name from James Wheat, who was a formerly enslaved man who moved to the Austin area. And several months before that, however, there was a man by the name of Joseph Carruthers, who actually was among the first freedmen who acquired property in what became known as Wheat Hill. But several months later, you have individuals like James Wheat, George Franklin, who was one of the early inhabitants of the property on which the Jacob Fontaine Gold Dollar building now sits, as well as other formerly enslaved families who were moving to this area in a location where property was being sold by landowners such as Samuel Haney and others in the community who were either looking to offload this property or in some way, shape, or form were friendly to African Americans in this time period. So you really have a wonderful development of this community, and you have a seemingly sort of disparate nature of Wheatville and then these northern suburbs of Austin. But of course, they were melded in many ways over their history. And one of the ways that we can see some of this coming together, if you will, is we know by virtue of the research that we've done on the Slave Quarters building and on the history of the Neil Cochran House Museum property, that there were several residents of Wheatville, African-American residents, who did work is domestic servants for the Neal or Cochran families over the course of those years. And so there was a physical connection, a personal connection between Wheatville and the Neal Cochran property during that time period in the late 19th century and onward. And so it's been wonderful to really be able to discover some of those relationships and see how it speaks even more broadly to a history of Austin and race relations in the city.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's really interesting because I hadn't read anything about that in what I've come across so far. So you talk about the slave quarters building, which is located in the back part of the museum's property. And it's recently become the focus of some initiatives of the museum to explore and reclaim the history of that structure. And I recently became aware of this project myself. So can you talk about how and when this project came into being and maybe the various goals the project aims to address or take on?
Sure. Rowena first contacted me, and I think we figured out it was in about 2016. So it had been some time with ideas brewing and an intent to really sort of revisit this particular structure. For years, it had been referred to by the colonial dames and the visitorship of the museum as the dependency. So just, you know, a generic term for any sort of auxiliary building or outbuilding on a property. But knowing the history of Austin, the kinds of clientele that Abner Cook had and building and living in general in the 1850s in Austin, you could be certain that this building would have been a slave quarters building for either individuals who were enslaved by Abner Cook and would have been part of his workforce or any of the inhabitants of the property prior to the Civil War. We had a little bit of a slow start. I had other commitments and the museum did as well. And ultimately, it was with my beginning to teach two courses in particular, American architecture and African-American experiences in architecture, which is a course that I developed in the School of Architecture, and having nice, eager students who were willing to help us take on a lot of this research. And so the way that I initially began to frame some of the work that we did to find out more about this building was in the form of a historic furnishings report. This is a kind of a cultural resource document that I am very well versed in vis-a-vis my interest in historic interiors and historic preservation. And so we began to think about and conduct more extensive research on the structure itself and its construction, the materials, who would have built it. And in addition to that, thinking about the occupancy of the site. That early on was much more challenging because, of course, we have the names of the owners and then in many cases, individuals who rented the house, because for many, many years, it was a rental property, specifically under the ownership of John Milton Swisher and Swante Magnus Swenson. And they rented out the property to a number of individuals or enterprises, including the Texas Asylum for the Blind. The site was the first location of that state institution. It's thought that Lieutenant Governor Fletcher Stockdale was one of their renters. And then the U.S. Army actually had a hospital here at the property. And so in thinking about those owners and renters, especially in the antebellum era, trying to figure out any enslaved persons that would have worked for those families or persons or institutions. And so we began to discover more information about those individuals through that way. It was a little bit easier once we get to the postbellum era in the Neal and Cochran families, in many cases, domestic servants who were white or black, who would have resided with the family or been present on the property when the census were taken, were recorded in that way. It was a little bit more challenging to fish out the identity of individuals who worked for the family and were referred to in really short oral histories by first name only. But ultimately, we persevered and were able to establish the identity of some of those individuals. And then right down to 1940, there was an African-American couple by the name of Lily and Hillary Kelly who resided on the property and would have no doubt resided in the former slave quarters building at that time. And so we've been doing a significant amount of research over the past few years to really begin to learn more about the building itself, but also repopulate it with the individuals who would have inhabited it either as enslaved persons on the property, employees of the family, or otherwise.
Wow. That's amazing that all this time that that history of that building sounds like it has been relatively unknown until recently. Can you talk a little bit more about this project that the museum has undertaken? exactly what it is, the mission of it. I saw information about interpretive plan. There's restoration plans and also some plans around proposing and instigating new programming around the building itself.
Yes. And so with the abundance of research that we were able to uncover and information about the building and its inhabitants, it kind of developed a life of its own. And so Rowena and I ultimately, because we have all of this information and in advance of any of the more formal sort of planning documents like the furnishings report and the interpretive plan and then the four programming, we wanted to be able to share that information. And so Rowena proposed that we developed the exhibit that was mounted at the museum as sort of an in-progress report, if you will, on some of our findings and where we might go with it. And then as a result of, you know, this wonderful information and then making those connections more broadly to the historic context of Austin, the book came out of the exhibit that we prepared. And then I'll let Rowena jump in here and speak a little bit more specifically about the programming that the museum is developing as a result of a lot of this research and our early efforts.
Yeah, thank you. So the book to which Tara is referring is called Reckoning with the Past, Slavery, Segregation, and Gentrification in Austin. And it does come out of this research in progress. This has been a very deliberate process for us, and we have taken our time because we want to do it right. We want to make sure that what we're presenting to the public is factual. There's so much misinformation to the degree that there is information at all. There has been a decent amount of misinformation. And so I think as historians, Tara and I both don't like it when dates are wrong. And we don't like it when we have to go back and say, actually, that person never lived here, or, you know, so we're very careful. But for that reason, it's taken a number of years to get to the point where we are today. We knew we were stewards of this structure that is, in fact, unique for the city of Austin. And I use that term carefully because I believe unique is unique. And the reality is that this is the only intact slave dwelling still standing in the city. And not only were we as a museum not fully aware of what this structure was because it had been so far removed from its original context, and because, as Tara pointed out, we were a rental for so long that it was difficult to access information about that early period. And so the museum really, for the most part, from an interpretive standpoint, talked about Abner Cook, talked about Greek Revival style, and then jumped forward to 1876 when the Neal family moved in. So we're talking 10 years post Civil War. And so it just wasn't on anyone's radar for many years that this structure could have been what it actually was. And then we started looking around and realized not only was it a slave dwelling, but there aren't any others left. They've been demolished, mostly because that downtown urban core, which is where you would have found structures like this, substantial secondary structures on property, so few of those historic sites remain. And in most cases, secondary structures would have been far enough away from the building that, you know, as lots were divided, they were demolished. There is one other building that has been embedded in a residence. It's not visitable and it's not really recognizable for what it is, but there is one other one-story structure that's still out there. But what we came to understand is that because of the period of time of our site significance, again, going all the way back to 1839, and the reason we go back that far is because Abner Cook was here in Austin at the time of the first land sale in August of 1839, and he, you know, is the builder of our site. So we're connected to that history. And then you go all the way up into the Civil Rights era. And when you think about the number of people who worked or lived on this property and our close connection to Wheatville and our close connection to the university and the development of West Austin, you can really see through our site a sliver of the way in which our city grew to be what it is today. And part of that story, an important part of that story, is this two-story building. And so Tara and I see it almost like a fulcrum point for the city of Austin, that taking from this one structure, you can explore outward through the eyes of the people who were here to really see a swath of what was going on elsewhere. So the project is called Reckoning with the Past, The Untold Story of Race in Austin. And the interpretive plan will cover four different eras. We have the antebellum period, which in Texas, antebellum doesn't mean up to 1861. It means up to 1865 with Juneteenth. And so that 10-year period followed by Reconstruction, which broadly speaking, we're taking up to about 1900. Then Jim Crow, 1900 to 1935-ish, 1940. And then the civil rights era going up to about 1965. And throughout all of these periods of time, you have people engaging with our site, working here, as well as living here, who are part of those stories. And while we would never argue that we tell Austin's story, what historic sites like us can do is by aggregating all of these slivers, you begin to gain a sense of a broader American experience. And so that's what the interpretive plan is going to be intended to do, is going to be not just to tell the specific stories of the people associated with us, but how those stories plug in to broader cultural developments, political developments, and how Austin came to be Austin. There will also be necessarily some restoration work done to the slave quarters. And the reason for that, the building is actually structurally sound. The NSCDA Texas, which still owns it, has been a very good steward from that standpoint. But as I was saying, its original context was lost. And in order to continue to use the building in other ways, as well as to protect it in some cases, changes were made that need to be undone. We need to remove false ceilings, and we're going to reopen a trapdoor space that originally connected the first and the second floors to one another, things like that. So that is a part of this project, because until we do that work, it will not be straightforward for visitors to experience the space in a way that is authentic to its original context.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Tara Dudley, an assistant professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Texas at Austin, and Rowena Dash, executive director of the Neil Cochran House Museum. The museum is steward to one of Austin's oldest historic residences, which includes the city's only remaining intact slave quarters building. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning Scott, alongside regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on April 14th, 2022. We're speaking with Rowena Dash, executive director of the Neil Cochran House Museum, and Tara Dudley, an assistant professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Texas at Austin. Beginning this weekend and continuing over the course of the coming year, the museum will reintroduce the slave quarters building located on the property to the public through a project involving interpretation, restoration, and new programming. Let's continue with the conversation.
And then, yes, new programming. We have already changed the way in which we interpret our site to some degree. Our tours are different, and so we share our site differently. But once we get through to the end, once the interpretive plan is complete, once the restoration is complete, there will be new curriculum for school groups as well as others. We don't know what all of the new programming will look like, but it will likely involve various ways to share narratives at our site, potentially lectures, living history components, public programming days. There will be all kinds of different ways in which we share the narrative and we share the reality of the lived experience of the people, not just here, but because of our close proximity to Wheatville, we will also be working hard to integrate those voices into what we do. I guess you would call them one of the most prominent African-American men in Austin in the 19th century lived just a block away from us, Jacob Fontaine. And in the public programming we're doing next weekend, we'll be shining a light on his work as a newspaper man. And while he never worked here, to our knowledge, he did not have a direct connection point to our site, the building where he worked was the most substantial structure in Wheatville and was prominently visible from the front yard of our site. And so it's impossible that he and the Neals and then the Cochrans would not have known of one another because their proximity was so close.
So I think you answered this already, that your project does not purport to tell the larger slave experience of Austin, but is anybody doing that you know of? I mean, this comes up from time to time. You know, it came up when they were remodeling Pease Park a year or two ago, for example, and other places. Is anybody undertaking a more comprehensive picture of the whole city?
To my knowledge, at this time, no. And so I think that's why this work is very groundbreaking and important, because I think it allows us to set a stage for other historic sites in the city of Austin, other institutions and entities to be able to look at that larger picture of slavery in Austin, or slavery in Texas, but particularly here in Austin in an urban situation, which would have been different from what we would have seen in rural parts of Travis County, neighboring counties, as well as throughout the state of Texas. And of course, with Austin being a young city and town, really a frontier town, there were certain circumstances that made for unique situations here in Austin that speak to not only the development and the early days of the city, but also to the institution of slavery here in the state of Texas as well. And so I think it's very important and significant. And like Rowena said, that we really have taken our time to consider what that programming would be like, what that interpretation would be like. But there are ways that we can speak to or connect to other contexts within the city of Austin. I'm thinking about the physical development of the city and building. And Abner Cook, of course, and any enslaved persons whose labor he would have engaged to build not only the primary dwelling, but also the slave quarters building, as well as his other well-known works throughout the state. And then thinking about the builders in Wheatville who might have been engaged in nearby work as well. And then speaking to the kind of labor that these individuals were doing, and then the different relationships as a place where we have an urban situation, as in many cities in the United States, a lot of enslavers hired out slave labor. And we definitely have that happen here on this property. For example, the Texas Asylum for the Blind engaged the labor of enslaved persons through their owners. And so there were several Austinites who hired out young girls to do domestic labor, a woman and a young girl at one point, a young boy around the age of 12 named Lamb, whose labor was hired out from his enslaver to teach the visually impaired students at the asylum how to weave baskets, for example. And so that also speaks to actual events and activities and people who lived on the property, but thinking more largely about the socioeconomic context of the city of Austin as well. And so I think that's a way that we can begin to tell this larger story of slavery in Austin here at this particular site.
I'm really intrigued about being able to look at what life was like and how oppressive it was, and how white Austinians took advantage of that system, even for good reason.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to understand this as Austinites. I think we get historically credit as a progressive city that is not entirely earned. Yes, Travis County voted against secession, but at the time, more than half of the white households in Austin were enslavers. So yes, Governor Pease was against secession, but Governor Pease made his money in Brazoria County in East Texas as an enslaver. So I think we need to understand the full scope of our history in a way that we as a city have really not wanted to talk about, well, ever. It's only beginning now.
Yes.
So speaking of bringing awareness of this history to the public, the weekend of April the 23rd and 24th is the museum's planned public unveiling of this project. And from what I understand, it's being billed as the Austin Slave Quarters Experience. And it's open to the general public and will involve several different opportunities for people to learn more about the building and better understand the mission and purpose of this year-long project. What exactly will this experience entail?
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled that we are bringing to Austin Joe McGill, founder of the Slave Dwelling Project. He is based in Charleston at the Magnolia Plantation, but for over a decade, he has been overnighting in slave dwellings around the country to bring attention to them and to the need for their preservation. This is only his third or fourth trip to Texas, which I think speaks volumes to where we are as a state in terms of understanding our own past with enslavement. It's interesting that you, in your introduction, talked about Forget the Alamo, because that is an important book. And there has been really important research in recent years, particularly Andrew Torgett jumps to mind as helping us to reorient our understanding of where Texas came from as an Anglo space. And for Joe McGill to only have been to Texas three or four times is crazy, because that's how Texas became a country, how Texas became a state. Enslavement was the bedrock of the founding of Texas. So it's a little bit of a tangent, but Joe will be here and spending the night on Saturday night. He's also going to participate in a panel conversation on Saturday afternoon with Tara, me, and Nell Gottlieb. Nell is an Austin-based artist who's originally from Alabama, who inherited her family's plantation home outside of Birmingham and has turned it into an art center focused on racial reconciliation. And actually, Joe was just at Wallace House, now known as Klein Arts and Culture, 2 weekends ago. And so he was just there and then will be coming here. Nell currently has a one-woman exhibition on view at the Neil Cochran House Museum called Reveal and Restore Difficult History Through Art, which details her own journey in understanding her family's past and the way in which this home, which she grew up thinking of as, you know, her grandmother's summer country place where they would go swimming and have a good time and eat popsicles, into understanding what that meant as a plantation space where many of the descendants of the people enslaved by the Wallaces still live in the neighboring areas. And so that's what this exhibition is about. And so she'll be participating in this panel with the three of us on Saturday afternoon. On Sunday, Joe will be anchoring a day of public commemoration of the slave quarters building. And he will be speaking at 2 o'clock in the afternoon about the Slave Dwelling Project and about integrating Texas and specifically our structure into the kind of larger national network of places he's been and how he understands the role those structures play in today's world.
So the project is supposed to be a year-long approximately project. And once the project comes kind of full circle in 2023, are there already plans in place for what will come next, or is that kind of one of the things that's going to be explored over the course of the next 12 months?
You know, we really want the interpretive plan completed in order to help guide us toward what we will become next. It's important to give space and time to that, because we could say today that we have ideas and thoughts, and we do. We have thoughts about how we might interpret the slave quarters. Tara's done really good work on how it's a two-story building, and so how the two rooms might have been used. And so we have some thoughts about the way that's going to shape up, but there's not much point in commissioning an interpretive plan if we already know what we want to do once it's completed. So we're going to give the space for that. I can tell you that we are committed to sharing a more inclusive narrative. And what I have said for several years now is that this isn't about replacement. It's not about throwing out one narrative in favor of another. It's about rebalancing and giving due credit and honoring the contributions of everybody who has been associated with our site. So that's the goal. And what it will look like, I think you'll just have to stay tuned to see.
Good. Yeah, I'll look forward to that then. First, I've got to come see the museum, though.
You do. You need
And so before we go tonight, for listeners who may be interested in the upcoming weekend experience and or visiting the museum like me at other times, can you share some ways that they can find this information out?
Well, there's a lot of information about the weekend on our website, which is nchmuseum.org. And there's a specific page dedicated to the Slave Quarters Project. And we're pretty active on Facebook and Instagram, so you can find more information there. The Sunday events are going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have live music. Roots Chicken Shack is going to be providing box lunches for those who wish them. And we're going to have people demonstrating basket making, movable type printing. Somebody is going to be out displaying historic quilts that kind of connect us to the Wheatville neighborhood. The movable type printing is in honor of Jacob Fontaine, who, as I said, was our very close neighbor. The basket making is in honor of Lamb, who Tara mentioned, this enslaved boy who had no agency in his own labor and his own, you know, economic interests, was tasked with teaching white children how to make baskets so that they themselves might have an independent future. And if there's anything that to me speaks to the inequities of enslavement and how impossible it is to wrap your head around that system, it is this 10-year-old, 12-year-old boy who was tasked in this way to help other children achieve their own financial independence when he had none of his own. The skills that will be on view that day are very much tied to an understanding of the people who have been associated with our site over time. And of course, the museum will be open. We do scavenger hunts for kids, which kind of gives them ways in which they can enjoy the space and encourage them to go into every room and to take a little bit of time. So there's lots going on. And of course, yes, we are open to the public. We're open on Wednesday through Sunday and invite you to learn more on our website.
Great. And I assume that if anybody else wants to contact either of you or learn more about the other work that you're involved with and the work leading up to this project, they can do that through the website as well, or are there separate social media information that you might want to share here?
I think my email address is live on our website, but certainly there is a contact us opportunity through the website for me.
I can be reached through my faculty profile in the School of Architecture at the University of Texas site, which is soa.utexas.edu.
Really appreciate you joining us this evening. This has been most enlightening, and I hope to make it to the event. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you to both of you again for joining us, especially on such quick notice. I was glad that we were able to pull this all together so quickly to the benefit of the event taking place on the 23rd and 24th.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, April 15th, and once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So you've got a couple articles in the print edition this week. The most notable one for me dealt with the EMS union and the pittance that the city government was offering them in terms of salary increments.
Yeah, so 5 months ago, the Austin EMS Association, again, this is the union that represents Austin Travis County EMS employees, they submitted an offer to the City of Austin's Labor Relations Office regarding pay and benefits. The city and the EMS union are in the middle of negotiating a new labor contract. Once it's ratified and signed off by council, will last for 4 years. So in December, the union submitted their offer, and they asked for basically a $7 an hour increase to the base wage for entry-level medics. Currently, that wage is $19.56. So would bump it up to $26.50, basically. And this is a long shot, right? That's a huge single year increase. City employees typically get, you know, 1-2% cost of living pay increases. We're talking cents typically. But the EMS union, their president, Selena Shia, justified it as saying, we've been working our butts off during a pandemic and this historic winter freeze. Our medics can make more money working as a ER tech in a hospital or a private ambulance company. Elon Musk's Tesla company hires paramedics that pays, I think, $26, $27 an hour. The union is saying, if you want to be competitive with these other employers, this is what you have to pay us. So that was the union's offer. Fast forward 5 months to a couple of weeks ago, when the city countered with their offer, which was basically a 39-cent per hour increase in the first year, with additional 2% increases in the following years of the four-year contract. Obviously, as President Shia of the union put it, it was heartbreaking. Even if $7 an hour was unrealistic, 39 cents was insulting to these medics, given how much they burnt out working this really physically demanding job, but also mental and emotional exhaustion of being around sickness and death and really high stress emergency situations, working 12-hour plus shifts. All of that can be very taxing for these employees. So yeah, they were really disappointed with the offer, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
From the city's perspective, they say this is the most fiscally responsible pay increase that we could possibly offer. Paraphrasing the city here, it's not that we don't respect the sacrifices and everything that our EMS employees have made for the city. It's that we just can't afford to do more. And they point to a few things. Primarily, it's these limits on how much cities and counties can raise in terms of tax revenue. These limits were imposed by the state legislature. Basically, if cities or counties want to increase the amount of tax revenue they get above a certain threshold, they have to hold an election and get voters to approve that tax increase. And the city's budget office is saying that this law alone is really hamstringing our budget. And a city growing as rapidly as Austin, with as much wealth entering the city as Austin, it's going to be difficult for us to scale up city services to keep up with that growth, as is. They also will point to HB 1900, which was passed this past session. That's the bill that prohibits cities from reducing a police department's budget without getting approval from the governor. But the last one is, the city is not just negotiating a new contract with EMS. They are actively at the table with the Austin Police Association and soon will begin negotiating with the Austin Firefighters Association. Firefighters and police officers also have gone through a difficult pandemic. They feel that they have been overworked and are exhausted and deserve a significant increase in their pay. I haven't seen what the police association or the firefighters are going to ask for, but I suspect it'll be more than what the city wants to offer them as well. So although they are not involved in this process yet, city council members will eventually have to take a vote on the contract for these three public safety agencies. They are all thinking about the fiscal aspect of it. How much of a pay increase for these employees can we afford, given that the budget office, our accountants, are already telling us just status quo without significant increases to the cost drivers of the city's budget, we are going to face budget deficits within the next couple of years. So that's the environment that the union and the city are finding themselves in, as they are really kind of deadlocked on this pay and benefits question.
At this point, it sounds like there's so much posturing going on. You just wonder what's on people's minds. What are the union reps thinking? And what's the city manager thinking? And are they both really eyeing something exactly in between? Or
yeah, I mean, it's really tough to say. Shia told me, EMS union president, that they kind of needed her and her board members and just the rank and file medics kind of needed some time to process the city's counteroffer. That's kind of the way they're reacting to it, but they will come back with their own counter. Less than seven, more than 39 cents. And then I suspect the city, maybe they'll go back and forth a few times. And if they can't agree on anything, they may bring in a federal mediator who is basically tasked with sitting both parties down and saying, all right, we're not leaving this room until we can agree on a figure.
Yeah.
This is not something that I've gotten from the union, but just as me observing this, I would suspect there's some kind of confusion on the union's part because they took a pretty bold stance in October in opposing Prop A, Austin proposition that would have dramatically increased police spending, really tied an anchor to the city's budget. The EMS union, again, opposed that measure, really to the frustration of police officials locally and in the state, right? I think we may have talked about this story before, but the combined law enforcement associations of Texas, CLEAT, the statewide cop union, they kicked the Austin EMS union out, right? We're not paying for your lawyers anymore, kind of thing. Wow. So they suffered consequences for taking that stance, but you could argue that they played a pivotal role in really saving the city and the city manager's office from what would have been really an anchor on the budget had Proposition A passed. So, you know, I imagine there's some real frustration. We really went to bat for you here as a public safety union, and you're still only offering us 39 cents an hour pay increase. So that's kind of my perspective, but it seems like that must be playing a role to some degree.
Turning the page here, I noticed your other article was a wrap-up of the city council meeting the week before. That would have been April 7th. We already spoke last week about the jet fuel farm out at the airport, but your article this week, you've got quite a bit about the property formerly occupied by the Austin American Statesman.
So a development group led by Endeavor Real Estate Group, they're a prominent developer in Austin, and some architects, they and the Cox family, which they used to own the Statesman, and they still own the property where their old newsroom sits down by the river on South Congress. They are eyeing this 18-acre tract of land for a pretty substantial redevelopment. This is perhaps the most prominent piece of real estate in Austin. It's not only large in itself, waterfront property, it's kind of the anchor of this broader 118-acre real estate known as the South Central Waterfront. And the city is working on really big plans to transform that area that's south of the river, but still kind of considered downtown over the coming years. But what we're talking about is this tract of land that the Statesman sits on. And what council did basically was give the first of three approvals needed to rezone the different tracts of land on this site for really tall towers, ranging between 250 feet up to 525 feet, and will include mixed uses, including almost 1,400 residential units, a new hotel, more than 1 million square feet of office space, and about 150,000 square feet of restaurant, retail, bars, things of that nature, mostly on the ground level of these developments. So again, this is a really substantial redevelopment project that has a lot of moving parts. There's going to be a tax funding component related to it that council is working on, and they'll take votes on later this year. But what council did on April 7th was give the first of three votes needed for the rezoning of this property, which the development group says is critical. This is going to be an expensive project. This is some of the most prime real estate in Austin, really expensive to build here. They're saying we really need this height to provide the housing, some of which about 4% as it is now will be income restricted, affordable to families making about 60% of Austin's median family income. But they're also planning a waterfront park, all kinds of mobility changes to allow for safer pedestrian and bike travel. They want to help build a train stop for the new Blue Line as part of a Project Connect. So it's, again, really expansive project that the developers say really require this rezoning.
So this is actually a PUD, P-U-D.
Right.
You likened that to the Miller development. It doesn't have the acreage of the Miller development, but it could rival the Miller development in terms of value and maybe even population. I mean, if you go up that high, you're talking 250 feet up, that's 20 plus stories.
Right. And PUD is planned unit development. A PUD is basically a specific set of rules governing what types of buildings can be built for a specific tract of land. Usually there's exemptions that otherwise would not be granted that are granted in the PUD. So that's kind of what's being negotiated here. And the main sticking point thus far is housing, right? Obviously, as we've talked about, there's not enough housing, especially the affordable variety. Right now, the developer is planning 4% on this specific property. Council is hoping to get 10%. That really complicates the finances of it. It's going to be a negotiation. Maybe the city will talk the developers into doing 10%. Maybe they'll land somewhere in between. Maybe the developers will convince council that they can't do any more than 4%. But that's kind of the main sticky point right now.
This could be a really big deal.
Yeah, it'll be certainly one of the most significant redevelopments in the city's recent history, especially for the downtown area.
Well, as always, thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to your updates again next week.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Bob. I appreciate it.
That's all for this evening. Up next is Co-op's unique mix of local artists' music. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, everyone.